Welcome to Fleischmann Hillard's Europe podcast, where the Brussels team and a variety of guests discuss the intersection of European politics, policy and communication, on and offline.
Stanley Pignal, one of the consequences of being active online is that it puts you more in touch with, or as some might see it, more exposed to your readers. How do you work with that?
Well, in a sense, it's nothing new. We've always been exposed to our readers. The letter to the editor is as old as newspapers itself. So if they've had something to say to us, they've always been able to do so. In the past decade or so, most of them have our email addresses, which are basically public, or they can figure them out. And many of them have been using that facility for a long time. Now, with more digital tools, you have more ways for people to get in touch with you. So it's not unusual, for example, to get a Facebook friend request from maybe somebody you've interviewed, or sometimes a random reader who likes your work. And of course, the latest thing is on Twitter. You find that there are lots of people who follow you, who first heard of you in your professional capacity as a journalist.
Okay. But does the expectation of being active online, so you yourself, you're on Twitter, you're an active contributor to the Financial Times blog, does that put more pressure on you in your daily work and on what you have to deliver?
Well, I mean, the big shift for journalists was the web. So we have, for the past decade or so, have had to produce stories not only for 4 or 5 pages of newspaper, but also for our website. So that's been the biggest impact. The Financial Times has a website that carries many more stories on it than the paper version, and some of them are updated through the day. So instead of having a single deadline at, say, 8 o'clock, you will have a deadline through the morning, which you have to update and then do something for the paper. After that, the blog adds on top of that, but I think most journalists see it as a nice to have. If it's a very busy day, for example, you're going to really focus your energies on your main corpus of work. And Twitter and Facebook and things like that are nice on top of that as well. I mean, we're not going to expend a huge amount of time on those aspects of our work.
And do you find that your readers take what you say in your blog as seriously as what you write in the print edition? Are there different reactions?
Definitely. I mean, we write for the blog differently than we write for the paper. If you read, for example, the Charlemagne notebook that the Economist correspondent has in Brussels, he periodically makes clear this is a half-formed thought because this is for the blog. And if I wrote it for the column, I would speak to a dozen people. But because it's a blog, kind of bear with me while I kind of stream of consciousness, and I take you through my thinking. I think in our case, in some ways, we uphold the same standard. So we're not going to write anything that is untrue. We're not going to write anything that's libelous. But people who read the blog, we expect to be more familiar with the context. So we can kind of take them through a different way of reasoning than we would readers for the general paper, who might not be as familiar with the EU as people who read our blog.
Okay. And do you find in Brussels that do politicians interact with you directly via Twitter, or is it still the more traditional means?
It's definitely still the more traditional means. Occasionally you may pick something up from politicians on Twitter or through their blogs, but actually very few of them have any kind of genuine interaction. You find that if they want to contact you, they'll still go through the traditional route. Many of them have spokespeople or assistants who are able to do that for them, rather than them having to type directly into Twitter.
And would there's plenty of sources of information here in Brussels. That the institutions have their own website, their information portals. Every interest group has a website or various microsites. But do you think there's enough good quality information on Brussels politics online?
From the official sources, I mean, they do spend a huge amount of time and money on it. The major institutions, so the Parliament, the Council, and the Commission, do have a very, very major web presence, and it is very useful in terms of finding documents, finding agendas, something obvious like finding who's the member of what committee in the European Parliament and who their assistants are. That is extremely well done. On top of that, you have an additional layer, which is quite new, of social media, blogging, sometimes quite less formal content. And that's sometimes very good, sometimes not very good. Usually I find it's good for a couple of months and then it disappears. Mm-hmm. And then it's good for a couple of months and then it disappears. And I always assume that there's a stagiaire behind there who was given the project of doing more social media. And then the stagiaire leaves and it might be continued, it might not be continued. So haphazard and certainly kind of can't really be relied on.
And outside the institutions, there is an emerging kind of blogging community. And actually one of our colleagues was one of the two bloggers accredited to a Hungarian presidency council for the first time today. How does that influence your work? Is that something that you'd be working on? Would you get sources? How often do you get sources from social media?
I read the blogs and I follow the relevant people on Twitter. So I must follow maybe 50, 60 blogs that are in and around European institutions. Some of them are focused on commentary, and it's good to provide a layering, a better understanding. So something like A Fistful of Euros is very good. Center for European Reform has a very good blog, but won't really be focused on breaking news. And a few of them are focused on the gossipy side of news. So Julian Frisch, formerly, was very good at that sort of thing. John Wirth, when he writes about Europe, is still pretty good occasionally on this sort of thing. But it's pretty thin on the ground. Those really are kind of among the better examples. What always surprises me is how few people do it. If you compare it to the blogging scene in the UK, for example, or certainly in Washington, D.C., you have very... Some of these are major players. Guy Fawkes in the UK is a major player in the media scene. In Brussels, you really don't have that. I mean, we are years and years away from having that. It's kind of interesting to speculate as to why that is and if it's something that's going to be remedied or if Brussels blogging is destined to be kind of a niche activity by very specialized and weirdly interested people.
Over to kind of the many interest groups in Brussels, you've got the lobbyists, whether they're corporate or NGO, regulators have said to us that, you know, where are the lobbyists in the kind of social media mix? What's your impression of how lobbyists are communicating that way?
Well, I'm pretty skeptical, frankly. Any regulator who says, I'm looking at social media for input, I think might be over-egging their interest in social media. There are formal consultation processes. Brussels is a process town, and the process tends to be looking at formal consultations rather than seeing what people think about a certain issue on Twitter. So I don't necessarily buy that argument. I think some regulators might look at Twitter to understand the general mood music on a particular issue, but the debate is really thin on most of these issues. I mean, if you take a trade agreement with Korea, for example, you're not going to get a lot of people tweeting about that excitedly. And the people who are tweeting about it, I'm guessing, are not disinterested parties. So in a sense, a formal consultation is going to give you more high-quality information than looking at Twitter and finding a couple of contributions from somebody who may or may not have a dog in the fight, as it were.
Thank you very much. Okay.